Hello. One weekend in 1964, the Scottish scientist Peter Higgs was walking in the Cairngorm Mountains. On his return to his laboratory in Edinburgh the following Monday, he declared to his colleagues that he'd just experienced his one big idea, and now had an answer to the mystery of how matter in universe got its mass. That big idea took many years of refining, but it's now generated so much international interest and has such an important place in physics that well over £1 billion is being spent on a collider in CERN in the hope that he was right. It's the biggest science project on Earth. The question to find the Higgs boson, a fundamental constituent of nature that, if it does exist, has such a central role in defining the universe that it's also known as God's particle. What is the Higgs boson? Why is it so important to scientists, and how are they planning to find it? With me to voyage into the quantum realm of the Higgs boson is Professor Roger Cashmore, the former director of research at CERN and now principal of Brasenose College, Oxford. David Walk, professor of experimental physics at Imperial College London and the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory. And Jim Al-Khalili, senior lecturer in physics at the University of Surrey. Jim Al-Khalili, before we start, why is this quest so important, just as it were a headline?
Well, I think ever since the ancient Greeks, we've been trying to understand the fundamental building blocks of everything in the universe. And we've come a long journey, and we've reached a stage now where we believe we know pretty much what everything is made of, the very constituents of all matter in the universe. But we're missing one or two pieces in the jigsaw, and we've got to this point where we're just waiting to be able to complete our picture of fundamental particles.
What is a fundamental particle?
Well, basically, it's an entity which isn't itself composed of anything more basic. It's the most basic constituent of matter.
So it's the basic building block of everything around us, this table, us, everything around us.
That's right. And I think the very first fundamental particle to be discovered was, of course, the electron back in the end of the 19th century. And since then, we've been discovering more and more particles. Some of them we've then discovered that are themselves made of more constituent pieces. We think we know what most of those constituent pieces are now, but there are still one or two gaps in our understanding.
So there's a standard model of particles, isn't there? But there is this key missing gap which is going to be filled, we hope.
That's right. The standard model is our best understanding of the particles that make up all of matter in the universe and the forces between them. And it categorizes particles into groups and families, these fundamental particles.
Can you tell us the families of particles briefly? What are these fundamental particles?
Well, there are two categories. There are the particles of matter, known as the fermions, and then there are particles that somehow mediate the force between these matter particles, the fermions, and those are called bosons. And there are a number of particles in each category, so they're subdivided into other groupings and families.
So we have quarks and leptons and bosons.
Quarks and leptons are both the matter particles that make up everything, make up atoms, make up all of us and the universe. The bosons are the particles of force that are exchanged between the matter particles.
David Walk, let's talk to you about leptons, first of all. What does a lepton do in all this, given that it's so important to us as we're talking that we're full of leptons? And what is a lepton doing?
Okay, well, leptons, the word is just comes from the Greek word for light, and they're named that because the first lepton found, the electron, okay, is much lighter than the other particles which were known at the time, which were protons and neutrons, which we now don't believe to be fundamental particles. The leptons, there's only six of them. There are the three charged leptons, the electron, the muon, and the tau, and then there are three neutrinos that go along with them. The very puzzling thing we don't understand is why there are three. Okay, the muon and the tau are much heavier than the electron, but otherwise seem to have the same properties. So we have these three so-called families, these three copies of the particles, and we don't know why there are three.
Still on the fundamental particles, Robert Cashmore, people have heard of quarks, partly because it's such a lovely word. Can you tell us what they are and how they relate to leptons?
Well, as you heard a few moments ago, Dave mentioned protons and neutrons, and once upon a time they were thought to be fundamental particles as well. But in the 50s and 60s, we started to find a plethora of particles, and clearly that wasn't the answer. And what grew up then was the idea that these protons and neutrons, which had many properties in common but some different, could be made up of some other particles, and these were the quarks that Gell-Mann and George Zweig invented. And you can construct...
You said invented rather than discovered. I know they have the same meaning, but it's interesting you chose invented. They thought of it rather than found it.
Well, they had patterns of particles to do it. So it's a bit like having a Lego that you're going to put together to make up different shapes. And we had the order, when I started my life in particle physics, the order of 50 to 100 fundamental particles, so we thought they were. And there was obviously, but they came in patterns. And Gell-Mann was one of the first people to recognize this pattern and said, once you get a pattern in science, there's probably something else underneath the pattern that produces it for you. And that was where the idea of quarks came from. He and George Zweig produced that idea. And then you could start with just three quarks, make up protons, neutrons, and many of the other particles that we see today. And that was a great step forward. But I remember when it was first invented, people thought this was just a simple way of trying to do complicated mathematics. And it was appealed to me because I was able then to understand what was going on. But it took a long while before people really believed that these quarks were there. And one of the ways that that happened was in the late 60s. There were experiments that were being done in California at Stanford, where you scattered the electrons, the things that Dave had been talking about, off a proton, and it looked as though from those experiments the actual electron was scattering off little granular objects inside the proton. So the idea that there were really quarks locked up inside a proton, and they produced the patterns of all the other particles, was then started to be really accepted.
So we're still talking about the building blocks, so listeners, of everything in existence coming from these things that we can't see, and we can only see traces of them in massive experiments. So we've got what? We've got the leptons.
Yep.
We've got the quarks, and then we come to the bosons. Right. Can you just tell us what they are first?
Well, you have the question of as Jim said earlier, of how these particles, let's take the quarks, hold together inside a proton. If I said there were two up quarks inside a proton and a down quark, the up quarks carry charge, and the natural inclination of them is to repel one another. So what we have to do is come up with another force that will hold these things together, will beat that repulsion. Now, all of these forces we think of as being mediated by bosons, the carriers of these forces, and that's where the bosons come in.
They give the quarks and the leptons mass. They carry a force.
They carry a force, but they carry the forces that are the interactions between them. We haven't got to the mass of the leptons. That was the big problem.
So we didn't know how they got their mass, these fundamental particles. There they were. They were fundamental particles. And the easiest way to deal with them was by calling them zero, but you knew they also had mass. But where did the mass come from?
Exactly. And I mean, that was the great conundrum that people faced when Higgs came up with his idea, because many people, Salam, Weinberg, Glashow, got Nobel Prize for unifying some of these forces that we observed. But it reminded all the particles to be massless. And that was Higgs's great triumph, was to go away and come back with an idea of how to give them some mass.
It is wonderfully romantic that a man goes for a walk in the Scottish mountains and comes back on Monday and actually realizes that he's had his one good idea, and then 40 years later you're spending billions and billions of dollars trying to prove what he discovered on top of the Cairngorms one misty morning. So what did he say that is so very, very important? Can we come to the bosons now, Jim?
The whole idea in particle physics is that we're trying to unify all the forces of nature, understand hopefully one grand theory that describes all the particles.
So right across the universe, from one end to the other, the thing called an electron is the same at one end as it is at the other end, and in the middle as well. That's the one thing.
Exactly.
Right.
And the thing that Weinberg and Salam and others that Roger mentioned described was how two of these forces of nature fit together and are really part of one overriding force. Now, there are the four forces of nature. There's the force of gravity, then there's the electromagnetic force, which basically holds us together. It's the force that keeps electrons in orbit around the atomic nucleus. And then there are two other forces which act inside the nucleus of atoms. And with quantum mechanics, throughout the 20th century, we've been able to understand how three of these four forces act. The one that's the odd one out is the force of gravity, and that's what many physicists are working on now. But to describe how these three forces fit within what we call the standard model requires seeing what they have in connection with each other, and two of these forces fit together. Now, the problem is that the electromagnetic force comes about through particles exchanging one type of boson, namely the photon. Another type of force, the weak nuclear force, comes about through exchange of two other types of bosons called the W and Z particles. Now, in the simplest version of the standard model, you would like to think that all these particles have no mass whatsoever. That's a nice, neat, symmetrical picture of nature. But unfortunately, the W and Z particles are heavy. The photon doesn't have any mass at all. So the problem that Peter Higgs was addressing was how come the W and Z particles are heavy despite the fact that they should, in this nice theory, look just like photons?
And so he invented this field. He imagined this field. Now, can you tell us about this field and what its function is with regard to the other particles? Can we imagine it as if the Higgs boson is magnetizing the particle? Can we use that word with any sense at all?
No, I wouldn't have said magnetizing. I would have said a sort of an analogy if people, I think, might be familiar with, say, bottles of syrup and water. And if you drop a ball bearing into such one of those bottles, you'll see it'll fall in a different way when you go down through the bottle. It'll go down through the water very much more quickly than if the bottle was empty. Very much more slowly than if the bottle was empty. And if it went into the glycerine or the syrup, it would go even more slowly. So it's that sort of interaction with the medium around it which gives it apparently different properties, different dynamical properties, different properties of mass.
So let's get this. Let's just pause here for a moment. This Higgs field is full of this stuff, and it's this stuff, whatever it is, these particles, and the boson is the activating force, which works on other particles, leptons and quarks, coming through and gives some of their mass, and out of that mass eventually comes everything around us at the moment. That's the deal, is it?
Is that the deal? That's the deal.
Right.
That's the idea.
Good.
You've got it.
I mean, I think something that non-physicists have difficulty with is the idea of a field itself. And the simplest example is a magnetic field. It's not something you can see or touch, but you place certain objects in that field and they know it exists. They feel its influence. So this Higgs field is something invisible. It pervades the whole of the universe if it exists, but it influences all particles traveling through it. And there are, every force is associated with a field. The electromagnetic field manifests itself as a particle, as the photon.
Why does an electromagnetic field? Why has it to manifest itself as a photon? Why is it to manifest itself as a photon?
This goes back to what I think Dave was saying earlier, that we've now got a place in physics where we know that you have this duality between waves and between particles, and so that we don't talk about things as just one or the other. Electrons, we can see them behaving as wave-like particles and being bent around, diffracted round objects, so that we always expect everything to come up in these two guys, as manifestations as a field or as a particle. And so if we want to look for a Higgs field, then we'll also look for a Higgs particle. That's the idea that we have behind it.
So we just have to take for granted now that there are waves and particles, or that there's this wave system, and there's a zap in between them, or these packages of particles. And
Absolutely.
Does the wave change into a particle, or do they coexist as waves and particles?
Well, the way I think about it is that they coexist. Depending on exactly which situation you're talking about, you use the most convenient description that you've got available to you. For instance, in the case of electromagnetism, if you have electromagnetic waves, which of course our listeners today are benefiting from electromagnetic waves, they wouldn't get this broadcast if there weren't electromagnetic waves. But we also know, and when we can get what are called packets of energy, the photons, which set off photomultipliers, which is the sort of experiments that Dave does. He's looking for these photons all the time in photomultipliers from experiments he does. But they're very important in a lot of other areas of science, for medical diagnostics and things like this.
Dave, Do you want to talk about looking for these particles? Because people, they're so very difficult to sort of get any grip or hold on them, and yet they're essential to any understanding or to the basic understanding of what we're, how we've arrived at what we are.
I think one can go too far in trying to make these things mysterious. It's only hard to see an electron because it's very small and your eye is very big. But essentially, the way that you see an electron is no different than the way you see anything else. You make radiation interact with it, it comes off. For instance, we now have the capability to trap and hold a single electron in a trap, scatter radio photons off of it, and detect them. So you can see a single electron by scattering something off it. Now, you can't do that with your eye because your eye isn't sensitive enough to see a single radio photon. But there's no fundamental difference between the two. You see, when you look out in this room and see the walls, you're just seeing light scattering off of the electrons that make up the material in the wall. So what we do in the case of our experiments is usually we try to make it easier to see a single particle. And we do that mostly by just making the energy very high. If you make the energy very high, then you can get a much greater disturbance off of a single particle. And then you can see it much more easily. Now, in the case of the Higgs, we have a second reason to try to make the energy very high, which is that you can't make any particle until you put enough energy into the system to produce its rest mass. Okay, Einstein's famous E equals mc squared. In order to make a particle, you first have to put in an amount of energy equal to mc squared. And then you have to put in some more, usually, in order to get the particle to have enough energy that you can pick it up in your detectors. Now, in the case of the Higgs, it gives everything else mass, but in the theory itself, the mass of the Higgs isn't specified. We know it has a mass, but we don't know what it is. And so we've had to search for a very long time for the mass for the Higgs particle by banging things together. And what we know is that we haven't done enough yet. We haven't banged things together hard enough yet to actually produce a Higgs boson.
So we're still looking for this wonderful theory, the Higgs boson. Nobody's seen it. And you were running CERN, Roger Cushmore.
Yep.
And now, can you just tell us the size of this job to find this particle? How big is the collider? We know masses of money's gone into it. And can you just give us some practical idea of it?
Well, okay, the accelerators being built at CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, is being built in a tunnel that housed a previous accelerator at CERN, which had a lot to do with the detailed discussion of the Higgs. Maybe I'll come back to that later. But it's 27 kilometers in circumference. It's about 100 meters underground. And running through this tunnel, there will be a large number of superconducting magnets, which run with very high magnetic fields in them. Now, the idea of that is the higher the magnetic field, particles, when they move in a magnetic field, get deflected. So what you're doing is you're deflecting them so they're going around a circle in this magnetic field. And as they go around this circle, you give them a kick at regular intervals to increase their energy with electric field. And as they get more energetic, you need a higher magnet to keep them in the same orbit, and so we keep them going around until we get to very high energies. Then we have some going one way, protons going one way, protons going the other way, and we bring them into collision with the very high energies that we'll be able to achieve with that accelerator.
And then you have the detectors to see what happens when this collision.
So at each point, it's 4 points round this ring, they're being built big detectors that between them will cost almost as much as the accelerator itself. They're very sophisticated detectors, and what they're looking for is when the protons collide, or rather the quarks that are inside the protons collide with one another, they will potentially have enough energy to put this energy E into a very small area to produce a large mass, if there's any particles around, using again good old Einstein and E equals mc squared. So the idea is that we build an accelerator which we know must be able to produce particles and get up to sufficient masses that we've got to find the Higgs, if the Higgs exists.
David, you want to add to that?
Well, The detectors themselves are an incredible piece of technology. If you look at the largest of these, the Atlas detector, it's the size of Broadcasting House, essentially set on its side. And the reason for that is just that we're producing particles of very high energies, and if you want to measure them very accurately, you have to stop them. It requires a huge amount of material to stop them. But this material is the most complex detector certainly ever built in particle physics. And in addition to that, it sits in this incredibly high radiation environment near the collision points between the two protons. And so it has to be able to withstand levels of radiation that are even higher than the core of a nuclear reactor. And it still has to work after 10 years of this. So this has been an enormous effort to do this, and it's required thousands of physicists from around the world to build these. They really are an amazing example of physicists from all over the world working together to produce these common goals.
Yeah, if I was to say, I mean, way back in 1982 when we first thought of the Large Hadron Collider, we didn't know how to build the accelerator. It took 10 years to develop the magnets and the technology to be able to build the accelerator. That took us up to about 1992. Then we knew we could build the accelerator. Then came the issue, can we build the detectors that will be able to detect the Higgs if it's produced in these collisions? That took about another 10 years, really, to develop the technology to do it, which has really pushed all elements of electronics, sensors and things like this to an unprecedented level. And now we're building it, and we know we can do it. So it's a good example of people, scientists, setting off an objective to do something and then achieving it, but it takes a while.
And, yeah. And of course, the reason why there's this so much technical difficulty in building these detectors, it was two reasons, really. One is that, of course, even if we do have enough energy to create the Higgs, that's not the only part that was going to be created. We're smashing protons together at such high energy that anything that can be produced with that energy through E equals mc squared will be produced. And so the big problem is looking through these billions of events that are going on and pulling out the one event that is important that suggests the Higgs exists. The other problem, of course, is that when the Higgs is created, it doesn't hang around for long. It has a very, very short lifetime.
In your terms?
I don't know exactly what the lifetime of the Higgs, but these are tiny, tiny for fraction billionths of a second. And the problem is then you don't look for the Higgs particle itself. You look for the decay products of the Higgs, the particles that the Higgs will decay into, and it has certain signatures. And that in itself is very, very difficult because, see, what it turns into depends on what mass it has. And since we don't know what its mass is, we're not quite sure what we're looking for. So it's a tremendously difficult problem. But on the whole, I think the majority of physicists are nevertheless encouraged that they will find the Higgs sooner or later.
Do you see this as a high-risk experiment? So many people seem involved and so much money in cautious countries like Switzerland with British physicists at the fore, like the gentleman on my right here. So it seems very steady and sensible. But looked at from where I'm sitting, to spend billions of pounds chasing something you don't know exists and you might not see.
That's the guaranteed payoff part. If we don't see the Higgs, that would in many ways be much more interesting than to see the Higgs. Okay, the standard model is magnificently successful at predicting what it predicts and magnificently useless at predicting anything else. For instance, when I say that the Higgs gives the mass to all the fermions, you might think that I've now explained the mass of all the leptons and the quarks. But I haven't really. I said where it comes from, but I haven't said how big it would be. We now know that if you take the lightest of the neutrinos to the heaviest top quark, there's sort of 14 orders of magnitude range in mass there. And the standard model doesn't explain where this 14 orders of magnitude range comes from. In fact, in the standard model, that 14 orders of magnitude creates real problems. It's very difficult to have a theory where you can have such a huge range of masses and it's stable. And so we think there must be some physics beyond the standard model. There must be something that's explaining these 14 orders of magnitude. And by not finding the Higgs, we might actually get a better hint as to what that is.
Yeah, I mean, let me pick up on that. I mean, it's not such a random activity that we're engaged in. I mean, if we look around at all the particles that we've got at the moment, and the previous accelerator, CERN-LEP, was magnificent in doing this, We've measured them. We've understood how they interact with one another. We've got very accurate measurements of lots of the parameters of, as we call it, the Standard Model. However, it doesn't work. Right? There's some missing ingredient. That's Mr. Higgs's particle. And it's wonderful if we do, in fact, come up with the Higgs's particle. But we know there's a missing ingredient. And we know that the experiments at the LHC that we will do will break our theories break down unless something new comes in, the Higgs particle, possibly. But it's because it could be something else. I mean, it's experimental science. You actually don't know that Mr. Higgs is right until you've seen his experiment.
When you're saying your theories will break down, does that mean that the world changes or you change? I mean, this table's still the table. I mean, your theories.
Exactly. We're experimental scientists, so the table still stays there. We've still got our observations, but we try to understand how they all relate to one another. Yeah. And at the moment, they don't relate to one another unless you have a Higgs particle.
Is this why it was called the God's particle by a physicist colleague of yours?
Yes, I think this Leon Lederman, an American Nobel Prize winner, because it's as Roger says, it's the missing piece in the jigsaw. We think we know all the fundamental particles that make up the universe, apart from the Higgs boson. Now, it may well be that even the Higgs itself isn't a fundamental particle. I mean, there are many theories that suggest there's something else that we should be looking for. In fact, one theory called supersymmetry suggests that every particle that we know of has another as yet undiscovered partner. It may well be that that's the way our universe works. We simply don't know. The Higgs could be the missing piece in the jigsaw, but then, as David says, even if we don't find it, there's a wonderful different picture that we need to discover.
Briefly, it's an awfully awful question to ask you to answer briefly, Roger, but when we're talking about Faraday and other scientists and whatever, they're doing experiments, they're discovering things for the sake of discovering them. Then modern worlds are created out of their discoveries. Do you see have you any idea of any practical consequences of finding, if you do find, this Higgs boson, this God's particle?
Other than the fact that we will have understood physics somewhat better and understand how physics works and the world around us perhaps works and can use those ideas and perhaps, as we've been hearing, move those ideas over into some other area which will have great benefit, I don't think I can, honestly. I mean, here we're really seeking after what made us the world around us the way it is, where did it come from? And I think those are great things to go for well. But I think I can't see any practical application. But, you know, you all should always be worried. I mean, even Faraday thought that he didn't know quite how he would his discoveries would be used, except he said to one chancellor, "You'll tax it."
Thank you all very much indeed. That was terrific. Next week we'll be discussing the Venerable Bede from the 8th century. Thanks for listening.